session for the applications of microprocessors to amateur radio. And again, my name is Dick Sherman. I don't do much here except introduce the speakers, who did a lot. We've had talks now on radio teletype and slow scan television, another area which perhaps is much older than the first two is transmission of CW. Well, these days electronic keyers are available so that you can send code pretty well if you are facile with your thumb and one finger, using paddles and memory keyers or just plain electronic keyers. But what's sort of interesting is to use an ASCII keyboard to type like you were typing a letter and have it convert that to perfectly sent CW. Well, that's nice, but the easiest part of CW is to send it because you sort of know what's coming and you can think ahead a little bit. What's not so easy is to receive it at any speed. And most of us have learned how to receive CW at 5 or 13 words per minute at one time only in our life. However, what our speaker is going to talk about is being able to, or algorithms for using a microprocessor for perfectly generating CW at whatever speed you'd like, and also adaptively receiving CW and displaying it on either a cathode ray screen like we have here, or a teletype, or whatever medium you have for display. Our speaker is Ivar Sanders, W6JDA. He's employed at a large aerospace firm. For those of you who might be interested, it's Ford Aerospace and Communications Corporation in Palo Alto, where he is employed as an electrical engineer in the design of computer-driven graphic CRT displays. So if you have any trouble with your TV typewriter, he's the guy to talk to. He's been a ham since 1959. And so without further ado, I will turn the session over to Ivar.
Thank you, Dick, and good afternoon. This presentation is really a description of two different algorithms, one that generates Morse code in response to inputs from an alphanumeric keyboard, and another which provides visual display either on CRT or teleprinter or other similar device of received Morse code. And the two algorithms are based on two articles in October 1976 Byte, entitled Add the 6800 Morse to Your Amateur Radio Station and If Only Sam Morse Could See Us Now. Now, although these articles were originally written for the 6800 microprocessor, this particular discussion will be presented using more general flowcharts, which can be implemented on any other machine that you care to use it on. And no attempt has been made to include routines which are unique to specific systems, you know, like keyboard input routines or display output routines. Now, some hams may argue about the merits of using a machine to transmit and receive CW at all. However, over the years, a lot of techniques have been developed to perform this task, and the machines work remarkably well. Not quite as well as a human operator, but pretty well. And they do provide a ham with the novel and sometimes actually even useful way to operate on CW. So let's take a look at Morse code structure and see what we have to do to generate and receive this Morse code.
We have lights. By the door.
This is the data format that we call Morse code. Now, the timing relationships for perfect Morse code are based on the length of time that it takes that you hold a key closed to produce a dot or a short Morse code element. Now, if we allow a dot to be 1 unit of time, we define a dash as being equal to 3 units of time. And the space between dots and dashes, or the inter-element space, we define as being equal to 1 unit of time. Okay, so that's one typical Morse code character. Now, how do we distinguish between characters in between words. Well, we vary the length of time that the key is held open. Between characters, we hold the key open for 3 units of time, ideally, and between words for 7 units of time. This, of course, is for ideal, perfectly sent Morse code. There are instances where we might want to transmit the individual characters at a rate faster than the overall CW rate. This would be useful, for example, in code practice. And the transmission algorithm, which we're going to look at, allows us to do that. Okay, the first problem that we run into when we try to transmit Morse code is how do we represent this the characters in our computer? Since the Morse code element, Morse code characters have a variable number of elements. Well, the particular format that we have chosen for this transmission algorithm contains 2 fields, a count field and a data field. The count field contains a binary number between the values 1 and 5, indicating the number of elements in the character that we're going to transmit. The characters are represented by ones and zeros, where a 0 represents a dot and a 1 represents a dash. And the elements are right justified within the data word. And the first element to be transmitted is located in the least significant bit. Well, now that's all fine for characters up to 5 elements, but there are those characters which contain 6 elements. So how do we handle those? Well, what saves us is that we don't have any characters with 7 elements. Therefore, we see that the count field for 6 or 7, if it were to be 6 or 7, the least significant bit really becomes a don't care. And the least significant bit of the count field then becomes available for use as the most significant bit of the data field. So therefore, whenever we have a 1-1 in the 2 most significant bits, we know that we have uniquely specified a Morse code character with 6 elements. This is great for most Morse code characters. There are 2 exceptions, however. Those are the inter-word spaces, which we arbitrarily define as being a byte of all zeros, and the error code, which is 8 dots, which we arbitrarily define as being a byte of all ones. So let's take a look at a condensed flowchart. Now, we're assuming here that this particular algorithm is really a subroutine that's called by another program as needed to generate a single Morse code character. First thing we have to do is convert the character to a digital CW representation from the ASCII that we get from our keyboards or whatever. We do this using a lookup table approach, where the character's ASCII code points to a specific memory location which has been pre-stored. And the contents of that location are the digital Morse representation of that character. Then what do? Well, we write rotate that data through the carry bit. And we check the carry to see whether it's a 1 or 0 to determine whether we have to transmit a dot or a dash. If the carry is a 1, we transmit a dash. If it's 0, we transmit a dot. Now we've finished the element, and we have to now insert the inter-element space. We check to see if we're through with the completion of that particular character, and then generate the inter-character space, and return from the subroutine. If we look at this in a little bit more detail now, we enter the subroutine and using the lookup table, convert the ASCII code to a digital CW representation. And then we separate that data word that we previously defined into 2 bytes, one containing the data to be transmitted and one containing the number of elements making up that data. And then we right rotate the data through the carry bit, checking to see if it's a 0 or a 1. And then we load a number into something that we call our timing factor register. Now this timing factor register represents the total number of ideal dot times that we have to delay in a delay loop. And for a dot, we set that timing factor equal to 1. For a dash, we set it equal to 3. And in either case, we turn on the key at this point. Then we delay the proper length of time according to the timing factor. Now that delay is equal to the timing factor times the ideal dot time. And we turn off the key. Then we set the timing factor equal to 1 again and delay one more time. Now this generates the inter-element space that we need to separate the elements in the character. We decrement the element count and check to see if we're through transmitting the character yet or not. When we're through, we once again load our timing factor register. This time we load it with a value which is the character space delay time minus the element space, because we previously delayed for one element space up here. Now for perfectly sent Morse code, the timing factor would be set to 2 at this point. However, this is where we can vary the code a little bit and make it other than perfect. If we want to transmit individual characters faster than the overall CW rate, this is where we would do it. We would use some number larger than 2 in the timing factor at this point. Then we delay for the appropriate length of time and return from the subroutine. So there we have it, a nice way to transmit CW with our computers. Now how about reception? Reception's a little bit tougher because there are a lot of ambiguities and irregularities in everyone's fist, and a lot of hams just really don't transmit CW that's very good in its timing. So the program has to be a little bit forgiving of things like that. Now this program is not going to work quite as well as a trained CW operator who of course understands the intended context of the data that he's receiving, but it does work pretty well. So how do we do it? We sample the audio input from our receiver, or audio output from our receiver, and we look for a change in the key on, key off, or mark space relationship of that audio. And we keep looping around in this little loop until we note that a change has occurred, at which point we record the number of audio samples that we've taken before that change. And then we process the data by checking to see whether it's a dot, a dash, or a space of some type. If a dot, we store that information away. And then we resync the sampling rate to the rate of the incoming CW. If a dash, we simply store that fact and return back to our sampling loop. And if a space, we first of all check to see if the timing for the space has exceeded a time which we previously computed, which would indicate that the space is a character space. If not, we assume it's an element space and simply return to the sampling loop. If it's a character space, we know that we've come to the end of a Morse code character and it's time for us to convert it to ASCII for transmission to our output device. So we do the conversion in a lookup table, load the ASCII character into an output buffer, and then we do one more check. We check to see if the space is longer than the space required for it to be a word space. If it is, then we load one more character into the output buffer, in this case an ASCII space character. In either case, we unload our output buffer and send the data to the output device while we're in the sampling loop back up here. Let's take a little closer look at these dot and dash registers and see how we really manipulate the data. This is an indication of what happens to our dot and dash registers upon reception of the Morse code character A. We start out and both the dot and dash registers are cleared to zero. After reception of the first dot, what we do is we first of all shift both the dot and the dash registers to the left by one bit, and then we increment the dot register, which effectively inserts a one into the least significant bit. And then we go on, and after we've determined that we've received a dash, we shift the dot and dash registers to the left one bit again, both of them. And this time we increment the dash register, effectively inserting a one into its least significant bit. And we wait a little while longer and determine that we've received a character space, therefore the reception of the Morse code A is complete. So what do we do now? We have one more thing to do here. We shift the dash register to the left by one more bit, and then we add together the dot and dash registers. And the result is a byte containing a binary value which uniquely defines a particular Morse code character, in this case an A. Let's take a quick look here at how that works if we look at another character. Let's take a look at an N, which is just the opposite of an A. Same thing, we start out with the dot and dash registers cleared. After we receive the dash, we shift both registers to the left by one bit. This time we increment the dash register. Then we receive the dot, shift both registers to the left, and then insert a one into the least significant bit of the dot register. This time when we determine that we've come to a character space, we shift the dash register to the left one more time, and then add the dot and dash registers. As you notice, we end up with a 101, binary 101, representing an N, whereas for the A we had a 100. So it really does work. Let's look in just a little bit more detail here at how we're do all this stuff. We start off and we wait for some period of time specified by a delay time value, which is modified further on in the program. Now this delay time value provides the timing necessary to lock on to various CW speeds. We check the mark space status, see if it's changed or not. If not, we increment a time counter, which counts up the number of audio samples we've taken. Check to see if we have to output any data to our output device, and then loop back around again. Now, when we detect a change in the mark space status, first thing we do is we set a data ready flag. Then we load the accumulated time count from here. We load the accumulated time count into either a mark register or a space register, depending on which type of interval we've just finished. Store the new status, reset the time counter to one, and re-enter the sampling loop again. Now this time around, we notice that the data ready flag is set. So we have to determine what type of data we've just received. First of all, whether it was a mark or a space. And if it was a space, we jump immediately to a little routine which handles that information. And if it's a mark, we have to apply some tests to it to determine what type of mark it was, whether it was a dot or a dash. And this is really kind of the heart of the whole algorithm here. If the mark is more than twice as long as the previously received mark, then we define the currently received mark as being a dash. And if the mark is less than half as long as the previously received mark, then we define it as being a dot. If it's somewhere in between one half and twice the length of the previously received mark, then we assign the same value to it that it had the last time through the algorithm. So assume for a moment that we've received a dot. Here we go, we shift the dot and dash registers to the left, increment the dot register, and now we have to resynchronize the algorithm with the speed of the incoming code. Well, we've arbitrarily decided that the ideal number of audio samples for a dot is 4. So therefore, we check to see whether the mark we received is less than 3 sample times. If it is, then we decrement the delay time value, which effectively speeds up the sampling rate. On the other hand, if the mark was greater than 5 sampling times, then we increment the delay time value to slow down the overall sampling rate. And if it's somewhere between 3 and 5, then we assume that we're probably pretty close to the speed of the code that's being received. And we merely reset the data ready flag and go back into the sampling loop. Now on the other hand, if we've received a dash, we first of all calculate a value that we use later on in the program, something we're going to call the character space value, and we let that equal 3/4 of the received mark time. Then, just like we did for the dot, we shift the dot and dash registers to the left by a bit, increment the dash register this time, and then we calculate one other value which is used later on in the algorithm, which we'll call the word space value, and we let that equal 2 times the mark time. And we reset data ready and go back to the sampling loop. Now what happens if we received a space? Well, first of all, we check to see if the space was larger than the character space value which we calculated previously. If you recall, that was calculated right back here at 3/4 of the previous dash. If the character space is less than that value, then we determine that we've received an inter-element space, and we just reset data ready and go back again. If, on the other hand, the space is greater than the character space value, then we know that we've finished up receiving a single Morse code character. And we perform that one additional left shift on the dash register, add the dot and dash registers together, and then use that digital Morse representation to look up an ASCII character in our lookup table. Then we place the ASCII character in our output buffer, and we just have one more test to perform. We check to see if the space is longer than the word space value which we calculated previously. If it is, we also store an ASCII space code in the output buffer, and then return to the waiting in the sampling loop. So that's it, little algorithm to receive CW. Now we've discussed a couple algorithms here to both transmit and receive the CW. So we can now key our transmitters with our home computers and merge our home computer and ham radio hobbies. And we can receive Morse code on our receivers and print it out on the CRTs and so forth. Incidentally, this is kind of a handy feature for code practice. So that concludes my discussion of the algorithms. We do have a demonstration system here. So I'll... you can do that now or later? Okay. Dick Sherman is going to show you how the transmission algorithm works here, and then apparently after the program we're going to demonstrate the reception algorithm on the hardware, which Vern Anderson has put together for us.
Thank you, Ivar. I was so excited by these programs that I put them into my system. Could we get the light back there, please? It's right by the door. There we are. Thank you. By far the more dramatic demonstration is to watch the letters come up on the screen as we're trying to receive CW. But since the screen is so small, I think what we're going to do is, after the next talk, we'll demonstrate the receive CW part, and that will be the end of our session, and so you can all come up and see how it works. What I'd like to do now, however, is to play a tape at various speeds of computer-generated CW. The message that will be transmitted is, this is a demonstration at the first West Coast Computer Fair. That will be the message as soon as I get my act together. You'll probably notice that all this stuff is being played on the industry standard, the JCPenney cassette recorder player. Okay. Now we'll see what happens. The first one is at 15 words per minute. It says here. If you can remember the days when you could copy 15 words a minute. It's honestly in here. Was all generated from the keyboard and transmitted through a code practice oscillator. 20 words a minute are coming up here somewhere. Change in speed, as Ivar mentioned, is accomplished by changing two constants in your program. The next will be at 25 words per minute. You can still copy that, I hope. all copied that?
Yeah.
All right, 35 words a minute. When you drop out, raise your hand. And how many are left? All right, 50 words a minute. Is there anybody left? We have one more. They said it couldn't be done. 1,000 words a minute. Get ready. Is there anybody left? Good. Okay. Well, there was a little more on there, but I guess we've done about enough with CW as we need for right now. One of the advantages of this program is that there are two constants that you can change. One is how fast do the characters come, and the second one is what is the spacing between them. Now, if you're using it for code practice for a person just starting out at 5 words per minute, the sending of the CW, the dots and the dash, is really drag. And you don't really get in your mind the sound of the character. You sit there counting dashes and dots. So with a proper choice of constants in the program, you can send the characters at about a 13 word per minute rate, so you get the fundamental sound of the characters, but yet the spacing between the characters is enough so that the overall rate is still only 5 words a minute. And that apparently is the much better way to learn CW. So this program can be modified in all sorts of ways. A random number generator can generate characters to be sent, and you can use that for code practice. After the next talk, we will have the demonstration of the computer receiving CW. You're welcome to come up here if you can use a squeeze keyer and send whatever message you like, and the computer will tell you whether you're sending it properly. We do have some messages stored in this AccuMemory keyer. Or we have one message, a rather long one, and we can send it at various speeds, and you can watch the algorithm adapt to speed, and after a little stuttering right after you change speed, it's right on then, from 5 words a minute to 25 words a minute. It never skips a beat if you don't. If you do, it prints what you sent. Okay. Yes. If you send well enough with a straight key, it works. And if you send well enough with a bug, it works. Yes?
How much memory did it take for the transmit and receive program in the existing setup?
Well, that's less than a K, isn't it?
Just about a K.
About a K. What microprocessor is that?
This is Motorola 6800.
All right, so it takes about 1 kilobyte of memory, and that includes a buffer in the transmit. You can load up the buffer before you transmit it, and then transmit it. So a lot of this is just buffering. Yes?
Has that been tied into an actual video receiver?
This particular one has not. Other people have.
I'm wondering what type of hardware interface they use to save the signal.
Well, they often use narrow audio filters, bandpass audio filters, to cut down the noise. This obviously does not work well when there are two or three signals on the same frequency. The human operator with his cocktail party filter can receive almost error-free a very weak signal in the presence of a strong one. This algorithm cannot. Okay. So still, we have not quite gotten to the point where we can replace people.
Make
with this, at least as far as CW goes. Bookkeepers, yes, but radio operators, no. Yes. Well, I use the constants that were in the byte article that this algorithm was derived from. I checked it at 5 words per minute, and it was about 6. So there might be just a small offset. So it could have been a little bit faster than 20. You could hear it at 1,000, though. It was a little bit faster. Okay. Do we have any other questions? If you have questions about the detailed parts of the algorithm, Ivar is certainly here and can answer those. Okay. Well, thank you, Ivar, very much for your presentation. Our next speaker, or speakers, are going to be talking about the computer control of a VHF repeater. It's one of the local repeaters in the Bay Area, WR6ABM. I think they're here. Lou, are you around? Oh, great. Lou Doran and his friendly assistant, Tom Watson. They're still arguing over who did most of the work on this. I'm not going to say. They're going to talk about the design and the philosophy of control of a VHF repeater. It's got multitudinous bells and whistles. If you've ever worked their repeater, it's a really fantastic machine.
Thank you, Dick. Well, approximately 3 years ago, Tom and I were involved in a program with the club to update the repeater for WR6ABM, which is the Grizzly Peak Amateur Radio Club. And at that time, we were running pretty antiquated equipment, some vacuum tube stuff, relay control, very good quality, high-speed control systems, vacuum tube CORs and transmitters and that sort of thing, COR being carrier-operated relay. How many of you out there are amateurs, by the way? My goodness. I'm surprised. Okay, everybody knows what I'm going to be talking about then. Well, we started out at the time when the only thing available was an 8080 and an 8008, of course, and the 4004s. And we looked at, prior to that, we had started the design out of discrete CMOS parts to work up our own processing system. Less than a microprocessor, more on the idea of a microcontroller, the control system, without a lot of changeability from software. It would pretty much be fixed programmed, although there were some changes that could be made. Then at that point in time, 8080s came down from the price of about $120 to about $70, and we thought, hey, that's probably something good to look at. So we started looking at them, and at the same time, I discovered one of my friends was the head of microprocessor development at Intel. And so I said, well, hey, that's pretty good. So I gave him a call, and he said, yeah, I'll give you an 8080 and everything you need. So I got together with Tom, and Tom and I have worked together in the business that I've been involved in, which is four-channel stereo broadcasting and communications. That's where my bailiwick is. And we decided to look at it. And Tom is a high degree expert in computers and software. He's in charge of one of the system maintenance and system programming at Stanford University on their Sigma 5 computer system, and has quite a knowledgeable background in that. And he took a look at the 8080, and the first thing he said to me was, yuck. And at that point in time, I said, well, what does that mean? And he says, yuck, again. So I felt that from two yuck's, that meant we went back to the standard CMOS. And then came the startling announcement from Motorola about the 6800. And so we pulled out I sent to Motorola for the application notes on the processor part, and I brought that to Tom, and Tom, being very skeptical about microprocessors, looked at it and said, hey, that's pretty good. It's a computer. It's not just a cross between a controller and an almost processor. But the only problem was it was $300. Well, we decided that $300 was better than 8 months of debugging discrete component software, so we went out and bought $300 worth of microprocessor. And we started working on a system, developing a system together. And what came out of that system was a microprocessor control system for WR6ABM. The first stages of development were first thing was to get a processor up on the air. So we got it up on the air using the Motorola software, McBug and Minibug, and found out how terrible those were. And Tom used those pieces of software to develop a control, monitor, and debug system that was the basic operating system. From that, we contacted a company located on the peninsula who was very interested in the work that we did, and they started manufacturing the boards and system that we had developed. And the system got to be known generically as MATIC, which stood for Monitor and Debug Integrated Circuit, which was the title of the program that was in the ROM in the system. So we developed a CPU system. That's the CPU card there. This is the same one that we use on WR6ABM. And on this card, we have a 6800 processor, 256 bytes of RAM, which can be used for stack or anything else. It's located up in high memory space. 512 by 8 bytes of ROM, which is the actual MATIC program. Full input and output buffering so that the processor itself, which unfortunately at that time, back when we did this, the Motorola was only selling processors with enhancement mode loads on all of their outputs, which meant that it was pretty much limited speed sensitive to bus loading and limited to the number of loads it could drive. So we fully buffered the board using some octal tri-state buffers. Also on there we had a teletype interface in the form of an ACIA, which was programmed compatible from the ROM itself, and RS-232 drivers. So pretty much a self-standing processor card. And to go along with that, we made a 4K static memory card, and our hardware version of the infamous but not yet released Motorola 6875, as the Motorola representative smiles in the back there. All of that's replaced by one chip, which was announced 2 years ago and still isn't available. but you know Motorola. Anyway, from that, we put together a system that had a lot of the features that were available in 2 meters, but a lot of features that would make a system applicable to being applied to WR6ABM. Now, I don't know how many of you people know that repeater, but that repeater has a reputation of being the CB repeater of the 2 meter amateur band because it's got so many users, and not to mention so many problems in the form of jammers and what have you, plus guys that like to record the commands with a tape recorder on the input and then go in there and start turning things on and off and up and down and around and sideways. And the repeater, unlike most, has a duty cycle of 95% transmit and or maybe 99% transmit and 1% standby and no percent intelligence in some cases. Well, we went ahead and put together a system that would do a lot of the functions, but would be able to be operated by amateur radio operators who didn't know the difference between their channel selector and their on-off switch. And the purpose for this is that a lot of guys on repeaters like this have gotten their license by purely studying or otherwise, and really don't have a good background in the electronics end, but they enjoy playing with the thing and enjoy using the commands and the touchtone pads. You know, this is the type of thing that is big now, is handy talkies with touchtone pads on them to do auto patch and control and that sort of thing. So we put in the repeater a lot of capability, but we did it by using a lot of the modern day integrated circuits that were available. For instance, the touchtone decoder is a 32-pin hybrid integrated circuit built by a company in Los Angeles. One that I would not recommend and soon to be replaced. And one of another repeater whose trustee is sitting in this room now has found the same experience that I have, and they're building another system as well that's a duplicate of pretty much what we've done. We also built some materials for identification. Now you've seen a presentation here on Morse code CW, Well, we did the same for our idea. However, we went one step further, and that was that we digitally generated an envelope-controlled sine wave so that there were no key clicks in the system, and so it sounded like reasonably clean Morse code without a lot of bandwidth.